I'm Michelle Trudeau. Just as in adolescence, there's good news and bad news about the brain in middle age, and ways researchers tell us to maintain good brain health. First, the bad news for us middle-agers.
Reaction time is slower. It takes us longer to learn new information.
That's research psychiatrist Gary Small from UCLA.
Sometimes it takes us longer to retrieve information, so we have that tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon. That's typical of a middle-aged brain.
Any more bad news?
We're not so great at multitasking. We're quick, but we're sloppy. We make more errors when we're middle-aged.
Is there any good news?
Complex reasoning is very good when we get older, as we age.
Small explains that myelination, the insulation wrapped around each nerve cell that increases conductivity, reaches its maximum in middle age.
So that means that the neural circuits fire more rapidly. So you're going from dial-up to DSL.
And Small adds empathy to our plus column.
If you design an experiment and you present several options for a young person, they're more likely to choose a more narcissistic option than one that tends to take into account the other person's interests and point of view than, say, a middle-aged or older person would.
One of the great discoveries from recent neuroscience research is that our brains are always changing, always developing, even able to grow new brain cells. In a recent study, one he calls Your Brain on Google, Gary Small trained healthy middle-aged folks who were novices on the computer to do Google searches. They practiced searching online an hour a day for a week, and then came back into the lab for brain scans. The scans showed significant increases in brain activity in the areas that control memory and decision-making.
One interpretation of that is that with practice, very quickly, an older brain can alter its neurocircuitry, can strengthen those neurocircuits, controlling working memory, controlling decision-making areas of the brain.
Research by neuroscientist Art Kramer at the University of Illinois demonstrates the plasticity, or the ability to grow and change, of the aging brain. In his studies on physical exercise, memory improves with aerobic treadmill training.
So what we find is that over a six-month to a one-year period, 3 days a week, working up to an hour a day, that people improve in various aspects of both short-term and long-term memory.
And people who exercised had larger hippocampi, a critical memory center. Other brain areas, too, central for decision-making, planning, and multitasking, were also larger than when they began the aerobic exercise program.
There are a number of regions that on MRI scans tend to show not just stability, but increases as a function of exercise in middle-aged and older brains.
And these scientists are walking the walk. For all you baby boomers out there with middle-aged brains, here's what Dr. Kramer, age 56, and next Dr. Small, age 58, do to keep their own brains healthy.
Before this interview, I was over at the gym, and I was riding a stationary bike and reading a few newspapers, and I was also lifting weights.
And I'll start out in the New York Times and I'll do Ken, and then either I'll solve it or I get to the point where I screwed it up and then I move on to the crossword. That's my typical day.
For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
In Antarctica, you'll find 90% of the world's glacial ice. But new research from the U.S. Geological Survey shows that every ice front in the southern part of the Antarctic Peninsula is retreating. Jane Ferrigno is the lead author of that new report. She says scientists have known for a while that some of the peninsula's ice shelves are breaking up.
That started at least a decade ago in the northern part of the peninsula. But we looked at all the ice fronts on the peninsula from north to south. In the southern area, we're finding that all the ice fronts are retreating. In the northern part of the peninsula, the majority of ice fronts are retreating. And that's something we neither expected, but were highly interested in finding that out.
Now, the peninsula, the area where this research was focused on, is sort of like the canary in the coal mine, right? I mean, what does it tell us about larger trends?
The fact that the ice shelves are changing on the peninsula is a significant signal that global change, climate warming, is affecting the ice cover of Antarctica. It's affecting first the area that's towards the north, that's slightly warmer, but the effect of the warming has traveled from the northern part of the peninsula to the southern part of the peninsula, where it's colder. Our next concern is to see exactly what's happening in the continent itself. We've seen some changes there, but we need to look closely and see what else might be happening.
Hmm. Give us a sense of how much ice has been lost over the past, say, 10 years.
I think I'll go back 20 years. Hmm. And in the last 20 years, I would say at least 20,000 square kilometers of ice has been lost. And that's comparable to an area somewhere between the state of Texas and the state of Alaska.
So about the size of the state of Texas in terms of ice has been lost in the past 20 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Can we measure the consequences, you know, here in North America? I mean, have we been able to see ocean levels rise as a result?
Well, this is a fairly small amount of ice when you consider the whole Antarctic continent consists of about 13 million square kilometers of ice.
I mean, it sounds so dramatic, the size of Texas, right?
It is very dramatic, and it is larger than the size of Texas. But when you consider the entire Antarctic ice sheet, it's still a fairly minimal amount. But the thing that we're really interested in seeing is that this is a sort of a red flag, because if the warming continues, if the retreat continues, if the amount of ice on the continent starts to flow into the water, then there will be substantial impact to the sea level.
That's Jane Ferrigno. She's a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jane Ferrigno, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today in your health, we will report on the mysteries of the middle-aged brain. Sure, maybe you're misplacing your keys a little more, but in a minute we'll tell you there's good news, too.
But first, we're going to see about what's going on in the teenage brain. When adolescence hits, you may find yourself the parent of a newly frustrating creature, sullen, self-centered, and reckless, or you might have been one at one time. Beneath that brand new mohawk, there is a brain. It just works differently. One scientist mom decided to find out why. Here's NPR's Richard Knox.
When her two sons hit adolescence, Frances Jensen found herself saying the same thing over and over again.
What were you thinking? You know, this is a resounding mantra of parents and teachers.
Jensen couldn't fathom her teenager's behavior. The surly moods, the exasperating changes of plans, the assumption that somebody else will pick up their dirty clothes. Now, Jensen's a pediatric neurologist at Children's Hospital in Boston, but her own teens suddenly seemed like aliens.
I thought, you know, I'm going to try to understand what's going on with this species, you know, these teenagers that we're living with.
What really got her into gear was her older son, Andrew. It was when he turned 16.
He's a very compliant kid, was a great kid, and then his grades started to slip, and this hadn't been an issue before.
I did dumb things, yeah. I got in trouble with the school sometimes for just not really caring, doing really poorly in classes.
He dyed his hair black with red streaks, started going off to school in studded leather and platform shoes.
I watched my child morph into another being, yet I knew deep down inside it was the same Andrew.
As Jensen dug up studies on teenage brains, she discovered it's not so much what they're thinking, it's how. Jensen says scientists used to think that the teen brain is just an adult brain with fewer miles on it. It's not. To begin with, a crucial part of the brain, the frontal lobe, is not fully connected.
It's the part of the brain that says, is this a good idea? What is the consequence of this action?
It turns out that the nerve cells that connect teenagers' frontal lobes with the rest of their brain don't work very well. They're sluggish. This is a little complicated, but it's really interesting. Teenagers don't have as much of the fatty coating called myelin that adult brains have in this area. Think of it as insulation on an electrical wire. Nerves need myelin for nerve signals to flow freely.
It's not that they don't have a frontal lobe, and they can use it. They're going to access it more slowly.
This might explain what was going on in the brain of Jensen's younger son, Will, when he was 16. He's a straight arrow student, good grades, high SAT scores, but one morning on the way to school, he turned left into oncoming traffic. He and the other driver were okay, but there was serious damage to the car.
It was totaled. It was down and out, so had to get a towed away.
And lo and behold, who was the other driver? It was a 21-year-old, also probably not with a completely connected frontal lobe.
Jensen says this also helps explain why teenagers often seem so maddeningly self-centered.
you think of them, these surly, rude, selfish people. Well, actually, that's the developmental stage they're at. They aren't yet at that place where they're thinking about or capable necessarily of thinking about the effects of their behavior on others. That requires insight.
And insight requires, that's right, a fully connected frontal lobe. But that's not the only big difference in teenagers' brains. In children and adolescents, nature made the brain to be excitable, responsive to everything in the environment. That's what makes kids learn so easily. But this can work in ways that are not so good. Take alcohol, for example.
Addiction has been shown to be essentially a form of learning. So they're tapping into a much more robust habit-forming ability that adolescents have compared to adults.
This came in handy in Jensen's own household.
Most parents they'll say, don't drink, don't do drugs, and I'm the type of kid who would say, why?
That's Will, son number two. When he asked why, his mom could give him chapter and verse about how drug effects linger for days. So if her boys were tempted, they knew what to say to themselves.
It's a fact that, you know, if I smoke pot tonight and I have an exam in 2 days' time, I'm going to do worse. It's a fact.
Will says having a neuroscientist for a mom was helpful with his homework, too, like when he was tempted to pull an all-nighter.
She would say, read it all tonight and then go to sleep. And what she explained to me is that will take it from your short-term memory, what you have been reading and what you know now, and while you sleep, it will consolidate it. And actually, you will know it better in the morning than right before when you went to sleep.
He says it worked every time. His older brother Andrew, the former goth, agrees. He's now a senior in physics at Wesleyan University.
I think she's great. I would not be where I am without her in my life.
As a parent myself who survived two teenagers, I can tell you there are no sweeter words. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
We're just a few hours away from the deadline for round three of our three-minute fiction contest. If you still want to submit your story, you've got until 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time tonight to go to our website. That's npr.org/3-minute-fiction, and that's where you'll find all the rules. Now, close to 2,000 original short stories have already come in, and our judge this round, Alan Chews, has been poring over some of them, and he's in the studio with me. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Guy.
Alan is also an author and the book reviewer for All Things Considered. And Alan, this round we asked our listeners to go online to npr.org/3-minute-fiction and look at the photograph we posted up there. It's taken by a talented photographer named Rob Hill. And Alan, how would you describe the photo?
It's just sharp enough to give you an idea of something that may be already forming in your mind. And it's just ambiguous enough to allow you to take it over and incorporate it into a story of your own making.
It's an open newspaper on a table, basically, and we're looking at it through glass.
An open newspaper that you just can't quite read, and so you've got to supply the text.
So this round, Alan, we have students from the famous Iowa Writers' Workshop, and they're reading through all of the stories, and then they're passing on their favorites to you. So what do you think overall? I mean, are you finding any themes or similarities, or are the stories you're reading going in completely different directions?
Well, they are as various as you might imagine several thousand people might invent. But, you know, at this stage, what I'm looking for are the opening lines that pull me in, just, you know, that hook me, to use that old cliche. And I've got some examples with me.
Yeah, we want to hear some of those.
This is the opening of a story called Sugar Packets by Tara Wright, who is from Menlo Park, California. You are everywhere I look these days. Everyone looks just like you. I'm at the coffee shop you went to just before you died. You used to write your name and phone number on sugar packets in coffee shops in those last few months. I don't know why, you said. I can't help it.
Wow.
So that really...
It's so evocative, the idea of the sugar packets. You can just imagine her writing down something on those packets.
Yeah, there's almost enough space on a sugar packet to write a three-minute
short
story.
Right. All right, what else do you have?
This comes from Janet Sadler in Sunderland, Maine. And this is again, specific to the scene. I got to the coffee shop inside the depot at 6:45. Only one bus out of Waterville. This was it. By the time Layla figured out I'd gone, and she told Mom, and Mom told her old man, and the old man told the cops and revved up to come fetch me, I'd have roared out of there, pink dust and exhaust stench, in a beautiful stream behind the wheels, the road open, and me sitting high up above it, looking out over the land.
And does it seem like a lot of people looked at this photograph and thought, this is a coffee shop?
Yeah, that seems to be the case.
Hmm.
And I found a couple of stories that really pulled me in that gave us some serious idea of what is in that open newspaper.
Yeah.
Here's one called Photo Finish from Gus Acevedo, who comes from Jackson, New Jersey. It ain't me, it's the horse. Others bet it all on a sure winner and lose. A horse like no other, like no other. So he thinks
he's
it's the racing form.
The racing form, right,
right,
right.
And I've got one more. This is a story called Lost by Jerry Warmuskirchen from Palm City, Florida. Lost, border collie, last seen on the Lower West Side near Hudson Park. Answers to Rudy. Teddy leaned into his paper, eyes wide. How do you lose a dog in the city? His voice bouncing off the windows of the donut shop. Did he run off looking for a flock of sheep?
So it's a donut shop, and of course he's using the newspapers
yes.
as a kind of this vehicle to tell the story that is could go in any direction.
Right, that's the diving board. Dive from this newspaper.
Now, Alan, when we kicked off this round of 3-Minute Fiction 2 weeks ago, you said you were looking for stories that would give us the greatest sense of a life in the shortest period of time. Is that what you're finding?
Yeah, I think the people who are steeped in short fiction and possibly even in short fiction do feel that sense of not just immediacy that a story has to supply for you as a reader, but that sense of urgency. Just a few words, get in, give us the story, and get out.
All right, Alan, our listeners have just a few hours left to submit for this round of 3-Minute Fiction. Do you have any last words of advice? Because, of course, over the next few weeks, you've got to pick a winner.
Well, in the few hours that are left, you can probably write a 600-word story. So I would say, sit down, start typing. You'll meet the deadline.
And once Alan does pick the winner, we'll invite the winning writer to come on this program with him. That writer will also receive a signed copy of Alan's book, To Catch the Lightning. Now, a quick reminder of the rules. The story has to be original. It has to be something that can be read in under 3 minutes. That's roughly 550 words, but not more than 600. And it has to be inspired in part by a photograph we've posted at our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. And that's 3-minute fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And you can find all of the rules there. And you have to submit the story through the link at that site. In a few weeks, Alan Chews will pick the winner for round 3. Alan, thanks for the update.
600 words, and they better be the right ones.
That's right. And thanks to everyone who's written in so far. We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. They're going crazy in Vancouver at the moment. Canada has won the gold medal in men's hockey. It was one of the most dramatic Olympic hockey games in history. Team Canada beat Team USA by a score of 3-2 in sudden death overtime. And it was NHL superstar Sidney Crosby who scored that winning goal. NPR's Martin Costi is in downtown Vancouver. Martin, where exactly are you at the moment?
I am on Robson Square, which is right in the heart of downtown Vancouver. It's the centerpiece plaza here. It's a beautiful day all of a sudden, and there's a sea of people wearing red and white and flags who are just going nuts. This is the game they've been waiting for all throughout the Olympics. This is the result they wanted. They were almost cheated out of it with this sudden tying goal by the U.S. towards the end of regulation, and this overtime goal just ramped them up into an even higher state of hockey Canadian frenzy here.
And obviously, I'm hearing some cheering behind you, Martin. Canada led during most of regulation, 2-1. The U.S. tied with just 24 seconds left. It was an incredibly dramatic finish to the regulation time.
It sure was. In fact, it was the opposite of what you're hearing right now. People were cheering. People were getting ready to win. And all of a sudden, quiet street
silence.
Downtown Vancouver. It was with half a minute to go, the Americans tie up the game that the Canadians felt they had to win. It was a tight time there for a few minutes. But when overtime came, they got it back.
Now, Martin, most of us know that the U.S. already beat Canada in a preliminary men's hockey round. How did Canada claw back to get to the finals and then win the gold?
Well, they had to play a lot more than the U.S. They had to play a whole extra game. The U.S. had won a bye by beating Canada a week ago. And So Canada had to prove itself with an extra game. They played Russia, another powerhouse in hockey. They beat Russia 7-3, and that's when their momentum started to build into this game. But the whole thing seems to have been almost scripted for maximum tension and payoff for the Canadian fans. They were down in the dumps after losing to the U.S. a week ago. They have this tight, this amazing close game, and then win in overtime. It really does seem like it's almost too perfect.
Mm. Now, Martin, had Canada defeated Russia, say, in the finals, I have to presume it wouldn't be the same. Can you explain why it was so important for Canadians that they beat the U.S. in this game for the gold?
Well, it's a little bit of that neighborly, friendly rivalry mixed in with a sense of sort of ownership over the game of hockey. This is their game, their national game, right alongside curling, which they won the gold in yesterday in men's curling. There's a sense that it's only in Olympic hockey when the usual NHL stars are divided up along national lines that that countries can really compete for those bragging rights about who owns this game, whose game is hockey really. And this year in the 2010 Olympics, Canada now pretty much is convinced it's made the point that it's game.
The Olympics, of course, had kind of a bad start with the death of one of the athletes in the luge. But presumably this has to sort of cap it off for the Canadians. We're almost going to wrap up these games.
It really is. I mean, this has been a story of redemption for these Olympics. It started off with such a dark cloud hanging over the games with the death of the Georgian luger on the training run on that luge track. And then, you know, there were glitches, there was bad weather, there were delays of ski runs, of marquee events on the, even at Whistler. Slowly but surely, the organizers sort of kept rolling with the punches, kept adapting, and the things started to really come together. And then, in the second week of the Olympics, the Canadians started winning gold medals like crazy and took the lead there. And the whole thing just sort of came together for the Canadians towards the end of these games.
Martin, really quickly, anybody wearing red, white, and blue there?
One guy was here earlier. He didn't get a lot of peace. He was sort of hounded out of here right now. I haven't seen him.
That's NPR's Martin Kosty in Vancouver. Martin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.